I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Presidential candidate John Kerry blasted President Bush's leadership and moved to focus his own campaign's position on the war in Iraq. Speaking at New York University today, Kerry said a four-pronged plan must take place in order to avoid failure in Iraq. And that plan included the U.S. must get help from other countries, provide better training for Iraqi security forces, ensure that reconstruction efforts benefit the Iraqi people, and finally, ensure that elections take place next year.
The president's insistence that he would do the same thing all over again in Iraq is a clear warning for the future. And it makes the choice in this election clear. More of the same with President Bush, or a new, smarter direction with John Kerry that makes our troops and America safer. That's the choice.
As to the troops, over the weekend, both Kerry and his running mate John Edwards criticized what they called the backdoor draft of reservists and National Guard. And they accused the administration of a secret plan for a further call-up of Reserve and Guard troops after the election. This as lawmakers from the president's own party lined up on the weekend television shows to criticize his handling of the war in Iraq and seeming to encourage the use of more troops. Here's Senator John McCain speaking yesterday on Fox News Sunday.
Airstrikes don't do it. Artillery doesn't do it. Boots on the ground do it. That's one of the fundamentals of warfare. And the longer we delay with these sanctuaries, the more difficult the challenge is going to be, and the more casualties we will incur and the Iraqi people will suffer, because they will be able to operate out of these sanctuaries, obviously now with somewhat of impunity.
Well, joining us now is military analyst Colonel Caleb Sepp, professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And Colonel Sepp, the Bush campaign says Kerry's claim of a secret call-up plan is a baseless attack. But John Murtha, Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania, who campaigned with John Edwards this past weekend and is on the House Appropriations Subcommittee, says Pentagon sources told him there would be this large call-up of Guard and reservists after the election. Your thoughts, first of all, will there be a call-up, at least as military analysts look at this?
To meet the numbers, Robin, that they need in Iraq, particularly as Mr. Kerry has pointed out, if we're going to support elections in January, those are going to have to be secured. Security is going to have to be provided for them somehow. And the answer is exactly as Senator McCain indicated, is there more soldiers are going to be needed to do that. Mm. It would be hard to imagine another way to generate that number of soldiers other than extensions of current service or call-ups.
Well, to the other point, this idea that there might be a secret call-up after the election, again, the Bush administration hasn't confirmed this at all, but in your mind, will waiting until after the elections be too late to put down the insurgency?
This insurgency is going to last a long time. That's the basis for it is very deep rooted, and no insurgency has ever been quickly defeated. So if there is a call up, it's an indication of a very sober analysis on the part of the Pentagon, probably, that that this is going to take a long time, and whether the call up comes before or after the November elections, it wouldn't have an effect for years.
Well, but both Kerry and Edwards are saying that they will end the backdoor draft. You and others are saying there are going to have to be more troops. If not reservists and guards, then who?
The call for international support is exactly correct. That's the right direction to turn. The question is how viable is that? This isn't the United Nations of the go-to-war United Nations of 1950, when the Korean War broke out there was a large coalition that sent combat troops.
Well, with that in mind, Colonel Sepp, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we just have a few seconds. Kerry today also called for asking NATO allies to train some of the Iraqi troops and to open training centers in their own countries for Iraqi troops. Just briefly, is that realistic?
It is. It could be done, and it would certainly be better than what's been done so far. The contractors that have been used to train the Iraqis have not done very well, and the use of National Guardsmen, who are not practiced at this like special forces are, who normally do it, has also not produced viable results.
Mm. Well, Colonel Caleb Sepp, he's professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. This is a discussion I think we're going to revisit. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay. Well, as we just heard, Iraq is getting a lot of attention on the campaign trail, but American voters have domestic issues on their minds as well. And today we're going to look at the health care plans of both President Bush and Senator Kerry. Karen Davis is president of the Commonwealth Fund, a private, nonpartisan foundation that supports research on health and social issues. She joins us from New York. And first, a full disclosure, Karen served in the Carter White House at the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, but she's not advising either of the candidates. And in fact, in some ways, doesn't agree with either of them. So, Karen, let's start with a roadmap of the different directions the candidates are heading in.
The two candidates have very different approaches for helping people obtain health care. President Bush puts more emphasis upon private insurance in the individual health insurance market and helping low-income people buy that coverage by giving them tax credits of $1,000 for an individual, $3,000 for a family to go and buy their own coverage. And he stresses this at least would be something you own, and that you would always have it. You wouldn't lose it when you lose your job.
This is part of his ownership society. We're going to hear the president speak about it in the moment. But what about John Kerry?
Senator Kerry, on the other hand, would build on the current system of health insurance, particularly employer coverage. He would provide catastrophic coverage so that premiums for employer plans would go down for both employers and for workers. He would also, and it would reduce employer premiums by about 10%. So he makes health insurance more affordable for employers. He also picks up half the premium for small businesses and makes sure that no worker spends more than 6% of their income on their health insurance premiums. He would also open up something like the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, which he calls a congressional health plan, and let small businesses get the same kind of premiums that the federal government gets by purchasing for large numbers of people and buying coverage as a group. He would also make sure that all low-income children are covered under state children's health insurance plans and would open that up as well to their parents and to other low-income adults.
Now, some people listening are saying, the Kerry list was longer. Does that mean it's going to cost more? We're going to address that in just a second. But first, let's listen to President Bush speaking about his plan and those health savings accounts that you mentioned. He spoke earlier this month.
Health care is more affordable under health savings accounts. And health care is more manageable because the decision-making is between the patient and the doc. And it's really important for people to understand that. This stands in contrast to a system where the federal government is going to say, oh, here's what's going to happen here.
Well, Karen Davis, the president's plan is, as we said, grounded in his ownership society approach. The individual is responsible. His website says he would give low-income families and individuals tax credits to buy a high-deductible health plan. They'd also get money to put into a health savings account to help reach that deductible. Your thoughts?
I'm afraid what he's put on the table really isn't enough to make health coverage very affordable to people who are now without health insurance coverage. He would give them a tax credit of $1,000 if their income was below $15,000 to buy individual health insurance. And we've learned recently that even an employer plan covering a single worker costs $3,300 a year. So $1,000 doesn't go very far for an individual. So many of those policies won't cover people with a pre-existing health condition. So only about 6% of Americans are covered through the individual market. Our own surveys show that what people really want is coverage from their employers. And most people who have coverage from their employers are very satisfied with it. They are increasingly concerned, though, about the affordability of care and whether they will lose it.
So Karen, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that people may not even want to own and be responsible for their own policies. And the conservative American Enterprise Institute seems to be agreeing with you that not that many Americans will qualify for President Bush's plan. They say it will insure about 7 million out of 45 million Americans who are uninsured. Now, John Kerry's plan insures quite a few more Americans, but the president has been saying that Kerry's plan amounts to a federal takeover of health care. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think Senator Kerry's plan is a federal takeover, but I do think there's a big contrast between the two plans. President Bush's proposal, his Office of Management and Budget estimated in January his plan would cover about 4 million people. Senator Kerry's plan, there have been several different estimates on the price tag, but they all seem to agree on the numbers of people covered. It would cover about 27 million people. So it makes a much more substantial dent in the problem of the uninsured and goes a lot further to make sure that a coverage is affordable for most Americans.
But how would he pay for it?
Well, that's the issue. And the price tag on it, again, the estimates that are out there range anywhere from $700 billion over 10 years to as high as $1.5 trillion. Senator Kerry has suggested he would pay for that by rolling back the tax cuts for people with incomes over $200,000 a year. So certainly it's a lot of money, but it's less than we have committed to other policy priorities, such as the tax cuts that are on the book and due to expire.
Okay, that's how John Kerry would pay for his plan, but let's remind ourselves of what his plan would be. Kerry would expand federal-state programs to cover more children, expand access to private policies, give subsidies to small businesses to ensure that workers can buy their own coverage. And under Kerry, the federal government would take responsibility for workers' catastrophic health costs. How would that work?
For employers, he says if you have a sick worker or the spouse of a worker, child of a worker, and they hit expenses of over $50,000 a year, the federal government would pick up 75% of that extra cost. That's called reinsurance, or he calls it a premium rebate pool. But that certainly would have the effect of lowering the cost to employers by about 10%. The second major thing that Senator Kerry does for employers is open up this access to insurance plans that participate in the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which he calls the Congressional Health Plan. And that would get small businesses particularly much better premiums than they currently get in the small business market. In addition, he would pick up half of the premium for employers with 50 or fewer employees, and he would pick up 75% of the cost of unemployed people so that they could keep their coverage under what's called COBRA, under a former employer.
Well, Karen Davis, we happen to have an owner of a small business on the line with us. Chuck Mott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Chuck owns Innovac. That's a family-owned business in Edmonds, Washington. It's right outside of Seattle, right?
Yes, it is.
Chuck, if you could sum up in one line for us what your concern about health insurance is right now, what would it be?
Well, it's the cost. Obviously, it has been going up at double-digit increases each year, and we cannot keep going down this road that we're going now.
Okay. Well, Karen Davis, you've heard this before. Tell you what, you both stay right there. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Chuck Mott, owner of a small business outside of Seattle, and Karen Davis, a healthcare analyst, and we will find out what's a small business owner to do. And later in the program, we're going to listen in at the National Archives, which houses Dr. Seuss and John Philip Sousa and all the president's men, and now is a brand new movie theater as well. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back to continue our discussion of President Bush and John Kerry's health care plans. We're joined by Karen Davis. She's president of the Commonwealth Fund, a private nonpartisan foundation. It supports research on health and social issues. Karen, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And we also talked briefly with Chuck Mott. He owns Innovac in Edmonds, Washington. It's right outside of Seattle. And Chuck, you were telling us that your biggest concern as a business owner is the cost of insurance. How many employees do you have?
We have about 35 employees.
And what's the? How does it work? I mean, do you offer them insurance?
Yes, we do, and we always have.
And what are you facing now? Because there are, as you know, there are many companies that are considering dropping their health insurance.
Yes. Well, the challenge that we face is basically this. We have several areas of insurances and benefits besides health care that we pay. The mandated coverages for unemployment, for workers' comp, payroll taxes, all of those things, we can't avoid those. We have to pay those. So then we get into the discretionary areas, which is contributions to 401ks, PTO or time off for personal time, and medical dental benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got six or seven cost areas that are increasing tremendously, and some of these other areas are going up much higher even than the medical costs are, you're getting to the point where you say, I can't offer all of these things. What I'm facing then are the discretionary areas, and maybe say there are three areas that are available. You pick two out of the three. You're not going to get all three because I can't afford all three of them.
Right. And you're not working with a union. So, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but
no.
you will literally have to give this mandate.
Well, again, we want to offer health care insurance to all of our employees and always have. But it's becoming increasingly more difficult to do that.
But they may have to give up vacations?
Well, that's an option. 2 years ago, we asked the employees for the first time to participate in the cost of the premiums. Mm-hmm. Prior to that time, we paid it 100% ourselves. That is as the employer. Now, and of course, in addition to that, we've raised deductibles, co-pays, such sorts of things. But even that is only going to do so much for you. The costs still keep going up besides that.
Well, Chuck Mott, owner of InnoVac in Edmonds, Washington, thank you so much for joining us just to share some of your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Karen Davis, in your mind, which candidate's plan best appeals to a small business owner like Chuck Mott?
Well, the typical small business might be paying something like $10,000 for family coverage, something like $3,500 a year for individual coverage. What Senator Kerry's plan would do would be to give that business half of the premium, would pay half of the premium in the form of a tax credit or a reduction in the taxes that business would owe. So that's certainly a significant help to a small business like Chuck's. The other thing is it would permit him to buy coverage a little bit cheaper by being able to get it through a large purchasing pool, which would be the federal employees' health benefits plan. Mm-hmm. So that might give him another 5 or 10% break in the premium. And the other break is that the federal government would reinsure the high expenses. So that, again, would drive down the premium. So it might get a premium reduction of 10 or 20%, and would pick up half of the premium.
But the Bush campaign would say at what cost?
Yes, it will cost federal budget outlays to do that. So that means making some public policy choices.
What are some parts of the healthcare picture that you think the candidates aren't addressing?
Well, I think that we've got a serious problem on our hands. We've got a major increase in the numbers of uninsured. They've gone up from 40 million to 45 million over the last 5 years. And as Chuck explained, we've had double-digit increases in health insurance premiums every year for the last 4 years. So I think we need fairly bold solutions if we're really going to get the healthcare system back on the right track. And I don't think either of the plans really come to grips with the underlying root causes of rising healthcare costs. We know that the sickest people in the U.S. account for most of the costs, and we just need to do a better job of working with families, having nurses help them after they go home from the hospital, so that they really understand how to take their medications, how to take care of themselves.
And this is all money, Karen. Who pays for that?
Oh, that one, it turns out, does save money. We funded studies at the University of Pennsylvania that have found if you would pay for a nurse to do a home visit after a hospitalization, you could reduce the proportion of very sick patients who wind back up in the hospital mm-hmm. enough to really reduce total health spending by about a third mm-hmm. a year. So that's one that does pay off. Others pay off in the longer term, and that means preventive services, helping people have their high cholesterol diagnosed and then controlled with medications. Those cost money in the short run.
I know, but you know, people are saying, oh, that can't possibly help the problem, but it can.
Right. You certainly can pay off in the longer term. If you control blood pressure, you're not going to have strokes. If you control diabetes, you're not going to have limp amputation. And we obviously want for our family members not to have those terrible things happen, but it's also savings in the long term. But that improved care of chronic conditions often can increase costs in the the short term. There are some things that get pretty immediate savings. For example, we funded studies that look at children with asthma who go to emergency rooms a lot or in the hospital a lot. And there are ways of monitoring the child's asthma at home through handheld devices, and they find out when children are starting to have flare-ups of their asthma, get them into the doctor's office.
We're not hearing about any of these things
from
the candidates.
So I would say neither candidate has really looked aggressively at what could be done to control costs through better care. Senator Kerry does have what he calls quality bonuses for hospitals that reduce medical errors. He's got technology bonuses for hospitals and doctor's offices that get computerized systems in their offices to prevent errors, but also to track patients with asthma, with diabetes, with these chronic conditions to make sure that they're coming in regularly and getting their condition control.
Karen, thank you so much for talking to us.
Good.
Karen Davis, healthcare analyst and president of the Commonwealth Fund in New York City. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats are cheering the most recent government statistics, which show that while the overall economy has added jobs, battleground states like Michigan and Ohio lost jobs in the past year. Well, Republicans are practically doing the wave over the job gains in the state of Florida. Is one candidate gaining more traction than another because of swing state economies? And what happens after, as expected, Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan raises interest rates yet again tomorrow? Well, for the answers and for a look ahead at the week in business news, we turn to Mark Zandi, chief economist at economy.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Nice to be with you. And the Fed, as you know, is expected to raise interest rates a quarter point tomorrow. That's likely going to frame this whole week of economic expectations. So tell us, first of all, not that it's all about us, but what does a quarter percentage interest rate increase mean for the average consumer?
Well, you know, Robin, it is all about us, and the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates a quarter percentage point, putting the federal funds rate target to 1.75%. What that means for a lot of us is that if we have adjustable rate mortgages, that we're going to have to pay more on those mortgages. Many of us have home equity lines of credit, and we're going to have to pay a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps most importantly, though, for those of us who are out there searching for a home, it's going to become a little bit more costly if we were looking at an adjustable rate mortgage as a possible way of buying a home. But now it's just going to be a little bit more difficult for us to do so.
People buying cars, for instance, that might change up some of that, too?
Yeah, that, too. You know, the automakers have been able to offer us these very cheap financing deals, 0%, and other financing deals, only because their cost of funds are so low, and that's changing now with the Federal Reserve tightening. As they raise rates, the cost of funds for the automakers is rising, and it's going to become cost prohibitive for them to pass that through to us in the form of these cheap financing deals.
Well, now, we understand that these interest rate increases are usually used to slow down the economy so that we don't move into inflation. But we understood that the economy wasn't really doing all that great. So why is this happening now? How is the economy doing?
The economy is doing okay. Growth is just above its potential. What that means is that at this rate of growth, we'll make slow progress in bringing down the rate of unemployment and underemployment. But what the Federal Reserve Board is fearful of is that interest rates are very, very low. If they don't raise them slowly over time, that they may have a real problem with very, very strong economy, more importantly, a booming inflation a year or two down the road, and they want to make sure that that does not happen, and they want to do it in a very smooth, orderly way, and that's what they're in the process of doing.
Right. Well, by the way, is there one or the other of the candidates that will be happier about this rate increase?
No, I don't think it really makes a whole lot of difference in the minds of the candidates. I mean, what matters to the candidates from the economy, the perspective of the economy, is jobs. I mean, are we creating them or not? And if we're creating jobs, are they good-paying jobs? And for those of us who are working, are we getting pay increases that are keeping up with inflation or beating inflation?
Right. Well, let's take a look at those jobs for just a second. Overall, jobs seem to be improving, but let's look at the swing states, as apparently every campaign advisor is now feverishly doing. Reports are that solid states, in other words, solidly Democrat, such as New York, or Republican, like Montana, have seen job growth. But what about the swing states?
Well, you've got the worst and the best economies among the swing states. There's roughly 10 to 15 really key swing states. The best economies are Florida, Arizona, New Mexico. And then you've got some of the weakest, if not the weakest, economies in the country among the swing states. Ohio, you mentioned, it's still struggling. Michigan, West Virginia. And then you have a few states that have had a real difficult time but seem to be making their way back. That would include states like Wisconsin, Missouri, Oregon. So you've got a lot of everything in this group of swing states.
Well, John Kerry jumped right on some of these numbers, at least. Speaking of Ohio, he says there's no better evidence of George Bush's wrong choices than Ohio's economy, which saw more job losses than any other state last month. Is that fair to criticize the president's or the administration's failure to create jobs?
Well, it highlights some of our economic problems. Clearly, Ohio has been struggling. It's arguably the weakest economy in the country, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon. It is very dependent on domestic auto manufacturing, and as we were just discussing, mm-hmm. the auto manufacturers are going to have some difficulty maintaining production and employment. So that economy, Michigan's economy, West Virginia's economy, they are truly this economy's soft spot, and it does highlight what the difficulties are and really what we're still, all of us are still a bit uncomfortable about.
Well, let's look ahead. What other signs of the economy are you going to be looking for this week? We were talking about homes. Home sales and durable goods are coming out, I know.
Yeah, those are the two key sets of statistics. We're going to get a new reading on what's going on in the housing market. The housing market has been the strongest market for the past several years. It's been booming literally through the roof. We'll see how many homes were started in the month of August, and we'll see some home sales numbers, and they should all show that the housing market continues to barrel along, and mortgage rates are still low, fixed mortgage rates are still low enough that people are still out buying. We'll also get a reading on business investment. We've all been waiting for a more aggressive business community. We want businesses to step up and begin to hire more, and we also need them to invest more. Mm-hmm. And we'll get a reading on whether they are, in fact, stepping up and being a little bit more aggressive in their expansion.
Or, as we said, buying durable goods, which is kind of how that translates.
Yeah, durable goods are big-ticket items, everything from computer hardware, telecommunications equipment, aircraft, machine tools. That's really hardcore investment.
Okay. We're now entering what's called pre-announcement season on Wall Street. This is where companies say they won't earn quite as much as they said they would. Coca-Cola was the most prominent last week. And by the way, why is that? We know Krispy Kreme got clobbered by the Atkins diet, but why wouldn't Coke earn as much as they expected?
Well, they're in a very competitive environment. They're battling it out with Pepsi, and also they've had some difficulty, I think, overseas. Overseas sales are a very important part of their business, and what happens there matters to them. But all businesses now are they've been through a good run. The last couple of years have seen big increases in corporate profits. Investors have cheered that. Now we're starting to see some slowing in profit growth, and that means certain companies are suffering a bit more, and their profits are now starting to fall, and we're seeing that in these pre-announcements. This is with regard to what happened in the second quarter of the year.
Right. And jury selection begins today in a pretty high-profile Enron case, not the one against the company's bigwigs, but this one centers on whether Enron and the brokerage house Merrill Lynch colluded to hide company profits in sales of floating power plants off of Nigeria. Just in the less than a minute we have, what message do you take from this trial?
Well, this is one of the more high-profile trials coming out of all the corporate accounting scandals. The corporate accounting scandals really have been very hard on investors and on our economy, and this highlights that businesses now have to fess up and to pay for some of their transgressions, and hopefully it'll send a message to everyone that we need to be a little bit more careful in our accounting and our business practices, and it'll make for a better economy and a better stock market going forward.
And as I heard someone say this weekend, maybe take Martha Stewart off the front pages and put Enron back on.
And I think that'll happen.
Mark Zandi, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at economy.com. Still to come, the National Archives in Washington, D.C. opens up a theater for the public. We'll listen in. You're listening to Here and Now. Ahead of President Bush's speech to the United Nations tomorrow, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry sharpened his attacks on the president's leadership in Iraq in a speech at NYU this morning. As we reported earlier, Kerry said Bush's invasion has created a crisis that could lead to a never-ending war. Well, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, is one of Kerry's biggest supporters. He spoke today with Here Now's Bob Oakes about the Kerry campaign and the war in Iraq.
A lot of named Democrats are concerned at the moment about the focus or lack of focus on the part of the Kerry campaign. They're looking at the polls, the bulk of which show Kerry trailing President Bush right now. Do you have a sense that the Kerry campaign is unfocused?
Not at all. I think we're in probably 10 days. We'll have the first of three debates. I'm confident about John's performance in those debates. I've been out in campaign with him. I think it's important for our friends to get out there and do the work and perhaps less complaining. We are committed to get a new direction for this country. We see this past weekend where Chuck Hagel and John McCain and Dick Lugar, three prominent Republicans, effectively said that the whole Iraqi policy is being mishandled. And we know that the challenges that are facing working families in this country with out-of-sight costs of health care and tuition going up and the loss of jobs. No, this is a race today that is extremely close. No one expected it that would be easy. I think John is talking about the things which are important to working families, and I'm very hopeful as to the outcome.
You just mentioned domestic issues, jobs, health care, economy. Should John Kerry be concentrating so much on criticizing the president's handling of the war in Iraq, which he is?
Elections are about accountability and responsibility. And what I think we have seen is that this administration and its bungling of the war in Iraq has made the war on terror more difficult to fight, not easier. And I think that this is an important issue. It's that issue as well as the economy. I think John Kerry has it about right. He's talked about his positive program to restore the economy. We've seen it other times. We had Bill Clinton as president. We had a strong economy, President Kennedy. We saw the restoration of our economy with John Kerry. Will have the same.
The flip side of the Iraq issue is that many potential voters are saying they need a clearer message about Kerry's plans for Iraq. What do you think he needs to say that
he hasn't said? First of all, we have to have the accountability for the current policy. The current policy is an absolute disaster on this part. You're going to have to convince the Iraqis, which this administration has not been able to do, that the United States are liberators, not occupiers. This administration has been incompetent. Look at this. We've appropriated $18 billion for the reconstruction of Iraq. They've spent $23 million of that, and they've done it not with Iraqi contractors, but with outside contractors, with single-source contract. No wonder the country's in flames. This is incompetency. John has offered a program, a competent program. He'll provide new leadership. You're not going to get restoration of Iraq with the current leadership. You're just not going to get it.
The president speaks to the UN. He's expected to largely steer away from Iraq. What do you want to hear him say?
Well, he's going to give up his go-it-alone foreign policy, a shoot-from-the-hip foreign policy. We're completely isolated in terms of the international community. And I would hope that he would go there and say that you're in the battle against the war on terror. We need the world community like we had them after 9/11, like we had them when we went on into Afghanistan initially, and all this country was united and the world community was united, after our go-it-alone shoot-from-the-hip foreign policy that's alienated the world. We can't fight the war on terror effectively by going alone. And I would hope to the president would go to the United Nations and announce a changed and altered position.
That's Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And two stories we're following. Tropical storm Jean has hardly the wallop of Ivan, but is still cutting a swath through the Caribbean, reportedly killing over 100 people in Haiti. Forecasters say Jean is drifting toward open seas where she might pick up more strength. Waiting in the wings, Hurricane Carl and Tropical Storm Lisa, and a tempest of a different kind. A CBS News executive said today that the network cannot prove that the documents it relied on for a 60 Minutes 2 story about President Bush's National Guard service were authentic. And the network says it was wrong to go on the air with a story it could not substantiate. There are billions of documents in the U.S. National Archives and 500,000 film and sound recordings. And a new theater at the archive will make those clips available to the public now. We're joined first briefly by John Carlin, the National Archivist and former governor of Kansas. John, this new theater is state-of-the-art, but it isn't your first.
We had one on the fifth floor on the north side of the building that was primarily for internal use. There was some public use, but it was difficult to get people to it because of the floor. There's been hit-and-miss programs in the past, but never have we had a facility of the likes we have now, of top-of-the-line technology. We'll use interactives, new technology, in a way to be exciting and innovative and creative for the visitor. But the focus will be to really communicate a message to the visitor, a message that records matter, a message that they're probably in the archives, that we don't just keep records of so-called important people. We keep records of anybody who's worked for the federal government, anybody who's been in the military, anybody that's immigrated to this country, anybody that's had anything to do with federal courts, and you can just go on and on. And I think when the people leave, they're going to, one, feel records are important and be excited about coming back.
Are there more films available? Are we talking about, in some cases, previously classified information, or?
Well, we obviously deal with classified records of all mediums, and when they do get declassified, yes, they're eligible to be used.
Of course.
For an example, a couple of birthday anniversaries coming up. One for Dr. Seuss. His birthday would be 100 years this October. We're going to have a children's program. He's a former federal employee, So we've got his civil service records. John Philip Sousa was another example they shared with me. We're going to have a Dr. Seuss, Philip Sousa weekend, the 30th and 31st of October.
John Carlin, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
John Carlin is the National Archivist in Washington, D.C. Well, let's hear some of the sound he spoke of. This is the character created by Dr. Seuss. It's called Private Snafu. Now, some might remember that word was coined in the military, and it meant, don't worry, parents, I'm going to clean it up. Situation normal, all fouled up. And Private Snafu appeared in a 1943 training video called Fighting Tools.
Oh, I'll be the war's greatest hero. With these guns, I have nothing to fear, oh. My guns are the best, they can meet any test. Oh, I'll be the war's greatest hero. Oh, I'm the world's best damn fighting machine, oh. Them Nazis will learn what I mean, oh. My wonderful guns will murder them thumbs, and I'll bury them in the latrino.
Well, we're joined now by Tom Nastic. He's manager of the new theater at the National Archives. And, Tom, I know that one of the things you'll be showing is a documentary about the restoration of the Charters of Freedom. Remind us, because that is, for many, the public face of the National Archives. It's the thing that people in the past had been able to see, and then they were renovated. What are they?
The Charters of Freedom are the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and the Bill of Rights.
And do I understand that they were, at least one piece was brought out of the building Elvis-like, snuck
yes.
out of the building. How did that happen?
It happened very securely. They were loaded onto a truck and brought out of the building and brought to a secure location where they spent the last 3 years being looked at and restored somewhat, and then re-encased in new state-of-the-art encasements.
I would imagine everyone involved was probably thinking they were doing one of the most important jobs in the country.
Oh, yes.
Well, as we said, there's a documentary of it. Let's give a listen.
There's hardly any ink left. It's as though it was washed away. The ink really is just a memory here. The intonation of the handprint, positionings of...
Tell me, what are the other sounds that are housed at the archives, just as they come to you?
Oh, our audio holdings are incredibly immense. We have everything from behind-the-scenes recordings from the Oval Office of certain presidents that are housed in our presidential libraries, everything from FDR talking to civil rights leaders in the 1940s about the possible integration of the armed forces, all the way up to the Watergate tape, the Nixon recordings. And from there, we also have entertainment programs, Armed Forces Radio, a lot of news programs from CBS and NBC, famous speeches.
Well, remind us, the new theater is going to be for showings of things like Fog of War and this documentary. Is there ever a plan to just put a loop of what you have in the new theater, or how do people see that?
Given the fact that our audio holdings are so extensive, that yes, I can see in the future we could do like a panel discussion or a program based around our audio holdings.
And can anyone come and just say, I'd like to hear JFK talking to members of the Warren Commission, please, and hear it?
Yes, but in fact, they wouldn't come to the downtown National Archives in Washington. They would go to the National Archives at College Park, Maryland, which is informally called Archives 2, and that's where the bulk of our audiovisual holdings are housed. And there's research rooms there where people can indeed walk in and, you know, have things pulled for them that they, you know, after doing a little research, they can have material pulled, and there are stations in the building where they can actually sit down and listen to things. And then if they so wish, they can arrange to have copies made, because the majority of the material in our holdings, being government produced, are in the public domain.
What's one of your personal favorites?
My own personal favorites, mm-hmm. I think. I'm a real fan of material from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole group of films produced by the United States government during the 30s to sort of document the government programs, the New Deal programs designed to alleviate the effects of the Great Depression.
Tom, we started by talking about Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel's contribution, his private snafu. We've been told it's Seuss to Sousa. What did John Philip Sousa do for the federal government?
John Philip Sousa was part of the Marine Band, so that's considered service to the United States government.
Tom Nastic is manager of the new theater at the National Archives. Tom, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Before we go, as always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line. You can leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. I feel at this point I should salute. You have your marching orders. We'd love to hear from you. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.